Welcome to WeAreTechnology.com's User Friendly 2.0 with host Bill Sickens, Technology Architect.
And this is User Friendly. I am your host, Bill Sickens. Bill, Gretchen, welcome to this week's show.
Hello there.
Do you believe that in the United States, 4th of July holiday is less than a month away now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Gretchen, I understand you're going to be celebrating by live fireworks, commercial level things.
All right. This involves an explanation. You have people
in my neighborhood
who are setting off professional grade fireworks inside the neighborhood. And I was surrounded by the battle of my town. That's what it felt like. And I had explosions all the way around my house. And I'm sitting here with my hose, garden hose, going, oh, no, is it going to land on the roof? I won't be able to spray that. Yeah, no, not
so
good.
The reason I bring that up, by the way, is because they are asking this year, please remember that a lot of places are in a drought and drier. There isn't the resources to fight fires like there used to be. Mm-hmm. And it's being asked that everybody just please be careful. And one thing that I would suggest on this, especially considering that this is a technology show, you can have a lot of fun doing displays with drones.
Oh, yeah.
It's no live fire or anything. You can program different colors, and it's really kind of a cool thing to do. And it's something that's kind of being used in a lot more places.
You can coordinate it to music, can't you?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And it's, and the other thing of it is honestly, for the amount of money that's spent on fireworks, you can get a good drone and have a couple of them and then just start putting it together and have something where you're not going to have to buy stuff every year, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway,
and maybe spend some money on some good food.
Yeah. You could do that too. I'm always up for doing that. All right. So that being said, what do we have in the news this week?
All right. Why do SpaceX rockets keep exploding?
Well, I could give my opinion on this, but let me give the actual answer to this, at least what's been provided when this question has been asked of SpaceX. So the explanation that's been given on this is that in programs like NASA and pretty much anybody else that's tested rockets, they take the time to make sure that everything is as good as possible and works before they actually do a live test. On the other hand, SpaceX has decided to take a different direction where they're just shooting them up. Whether or not they've been completely tested out and then using that data to build the next one. So again, according to SpaceX, that's why all of their rockets are blowing up.
So they're shooting up?
They're shooting the rocket up. Yes, thank you, Gretchen, for that.
Well, I don't know.
You never know.
Yeah.
Yeah, so in other words, bad engineering. Got it.
I have no comment on that. What's next?
Something surprising is destroying Elon Musk's Starlink satellites.
Yeah, on the note of bad engineering. In all seriousness, though, this is something that is actually becoming a huge problem. Right now, there are more than 7,000 Starlink satellites in orbit. That's a lot.
Uh-huh.
And it's the first time that there's really been a way to study these constellation-based spacecraft in this way. And what it turns out it is that due to the solar storms and other things, that's causing problems with the electronics on board and is causing them to dive back into orbit. Now, these things are designed when they wear out that they would drop in anyway, and they're supposed to disintegrate and that type of a thing. But the quantity and the fact that this is happening prematurely is creating some concern that it is possible that stuff will survive reentry. So, you know, it's something to be careful of. We haven't seen that happening yet, but there was one piece that was found from one of these that was fairly intact that landed in a field. So it can happen. Hopefully they'll be able to get this under control.
TSA warns smartphone users, you must bring this to the airport. So what is this?
Yeah, so when I first heard this, I thought there was some new regulation or something that if you're going to bring a phone, you have to bring something else. But that's not exactly what this is. What this is a power bank. So in other words, a way to recharge your phone, because it is increasingly happening. This thing called juice jacking, which is nothing new in of itself, but it's getting a lot more complicated and you can't tell that if you plug your phone into a USB port or certainly a USB cable at a public location like an airport, there is software that can compromise your phone on some of them, or they can download the information from your phone and do nefarious things with it. And since a lot of us carry financial data and everything else on the phones now, this is something that definitely the bad guys are after. So what the TSA is advising is to get a power bank, carry it with you, a TSA approved power bank. I'm not entirely sure what that is, if there's an approval process. I think they want ones that are safe, especially with some of the problems with batteries and Samsung a few years back and that type of thing. And to have that as a way to be able to recharge your phone, and then conceivably you would recharge the power bank from a wall outlet, which is safe. So something definitely to think about. And you know what? These are really true things, because at the end of the day, the bad guys are getting better at what they're doing, and what they want to do is basically separate you from your money one way or the other. And a lot of the things, the schemes that are coming out and stuff, are things that wouldn't have been thought of a few years ago. Again, juice jacking is nothing new, but the frequency at which it's happening and the fact that they're starting to be able to hide the electronics a lot better than they used to is where the concern's coming out. And the TSA just wants us all to be aware of it. And definitely, if you want to be completely safe, use your own equipment, bring a battery pack.
In sad news, Disney layoffs, hundreds cut in TV and film entertainment.
Yeah, so Disney's been having some problems. Movies not doing well, that type of a thing. And to that end, they are cutting back a lot of their staff in a lot of different places, and places that you wouldn't have necessarily thought that that would have happened. So they've established a goal of at least $7.5 billion in cost reductions, which is about 7,000 jobs eliminated, among other things. This was set back in 2023, and now they're executing. So at the end of the day, when you don't do well, even if you're a big company and have some problems, it creates a situation just like it does with smaller businesses. Now, they may be a little bit easier or more able to ride this and pull out of it than a smaller business that doesn't have as much money on hand. But again, the Snow White movie was kind of a big deal, that it really went down as much as it did. And they're concerned about Fantastic Four. We talked about that on an earlier show, I know. But that is kind of where this is going. So the new CEO is actually talking about also creating new jobs in the parks and some things like that. But I think we're going to see a lot of transition and possibly a spinoff of some of these franchises in the next little bit.
All right. Bacteria exhales electricity like tiny living power plants.
Well, that sounds interesting. So this comes from Rice University, and they've discovered a type of bacteria that can generate electricity while, quote unquote, breathing. Okay. So this is kind of cool if this actually was to really be able to be exploited.
It's tiny Sith lords.
Yeah, tiny Sith lords. Except in this case, they're, I don't think we want tiny Sith lords, but, but the thing of it is this actually is an alternative form of energy that wouldn't have been thought about. And the other side of it is because they don't require oxygen, these could exist in extreme environments, low oxygen environments. So, you know, definitely another thing where sci-fi and real world seems to be crossing over, because this is almost like something that I think Star Trek Voyager looked at with living components in their computers and things. It'll be interesting to see where this goes, or if it goes anywhere. And, you know, I don't know. All I thought of when I saw this is perhaps this is what powers Pikachu. I don't know.
The strongest solar storm of the year promises spectacular auroras.
Yes, and as I have complained in the past, I'm still not able to see these, even though everybody else seems to.
I haven't. Yeah, yeah.
So this solar storm ran through the 3rd, which was this last week. And there's a rating for these. The most the most intense level, that is a 9 or a 10. And this one almost hit a 9 or 8 or a 9. So what's going on here is there's an 11-year cycle that the sun goes through. And during that cycle, it comes to a part where it has a lot of radiation that is thrown out from the sun. And there's a lot better ways to explain that that we don't have time to dig into today, but basically that's what it is. And the radiation from that impacts our electronics. This is nothing new. This is something the sun's been doing since the sun has been there, but us having high-end electronic systems has not. So like we were talking about earlier, this is affecting the Starlink satellites, but that's not the only thing. It basically can affect pretty much any electronic system that is out there. But the flip side of it is it's what creates Aurora Borealis, or the Northern Lights, which is really a cool thing to see, so I am told. Because even though this has supposedly happened a number of times now up here in Oregon where I am, I have diligently looked but not been able to see anything. So I think, you know, the only solution to this, guys, is I think the three of us need to take a trip to Iceland so that we can actually see these. What do you think?
Be cool.
Oh, yeah.
New satellite images show damaged Russian bombers from Ukraine drone attack.
Yeah, Ukraine has been, and I think has successfully here, given the idea that they are still not only in the game, but they actually do hold the cards. Doing this, they took out about a third of the Russian bombers. And from that standpoint, just alone, that is an incredible big deal. But it does go to show alternate uses for drones. I personally would prefer to use mine for a 4th of July display, honestly. But, you know, they can do a lot of different things. But it is kind of interesting to see this, because this is something that's been produced by Ukraine to be able to defend themselves, and something that was quite successfully used and has made a really a good dent in things. I think people are noticing.
Yeah. After 12 years of failed attempts, the man who lost his hard drive containing $742 million in Bitcoin finally ends his search.
So we talked about this about 3 years ago on the show. If you guys don't remember, well, shame on you. I mean, you should just remember verbatim everything we've done, even 3 years out. I had to look it up myself. But what is basically going on here is this is a story from Newport in the UK. And this gentleman, an IT worker, South Wales, an IT worker called James Howells, had a hard drive and he had Bitcoins on him back in 2013. He much lower value and that type of a thing. And at that time, he accidentally threw out the hard drive.
Oh.
So since Bitcoin has gone through the ceiling and the amount that he has on there, 8,000 Bitcoins at current exchange, let's just say is a lot of money. And whatever that amount is changes day by day, but it would certainly be something that I'd want to get back. What was on the hard drive was the private key to his Bitcoin wallet, which cannot be replaced. And at that time, it was a modest value, so it wasn't thought about that much. But when, like I say, the price started going up, he wanted to get the hard drive back and has attempted since then for, 12, 13 years now, to go through a number of processes to figure out what happened to this thing. The hard drive was thrown away in a landfill. And first of all, I really felt for him. I was hoping that somehow, some way, he'd be able to do this. But first of all, usually when stuff goes into a landfill, because of environmental regulations, if nothing else, you're not allowed to go in and dig through and try to get things back out. So that's one thing. But the second thing of it is, well, Bill, maybe you can comment on this. What happens when you throw a hard drive in a landfill?
Well, considering usually how acidic that landfills are, they usually destroy pretty much everything plastic.
Yeah.
On a hard drive.
Yeah. And it's just going to break it down. Not to mention the fact that in a lot of landfills, it's probably been recycled too, you know, or disassembled because electronics, they do things like we have an e-waste program up here that is good. And it goes through to try to get rid of toxic materials and stuff. And certainly a hard drive would fall under that. And over the years, he's tried a number of different things and spent a lot of money, including AI powered drones, robotic systems, things like that, to safely search the landfill without causing environmental damage and not run afoul of the law. And, you know, and the story goes on from that and from that. So it's created a number of legal obstacles, as I would think anybody would guess. And last year, a British judge ruled that his recovery efforts had no realistic prospect of success. And after that, it kind of was game over for all of this. So it is definitely an interesting thing to see where something like that really cannot be recovered. It is worth a lot of money, but whatever you might try to do, if it's gone, it's gone. And, you know, the other question I have to ask about this too, with cryptocurrency, Bitcoin in general, does that mean that that Bitcoin is just no longer there? Or, you know, how would that work? Because like, if you have currency and it gets destroyed, eventually they make new currency, but that's not the case with Bitcoin. So I'd be curious if any of our listeners would know an answer to a question like that. If you lose your wallet key and can't get to those coins, are they just locked up forever and that's the end of it? Or is there actually something that maybe you can do? I don't know.
I don't know either.
Not into Bitcoin.
So let's move on to a more positive topic. And this is something that, as much as I've told everybody, I don't seem to be believed, but I accidentally got an arcade.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that has been the general reaction. So I've talked about this before. I'm in the process of doing a repair show called Bill Builds. And in line with that, we had put out word if anybody had electronics, you know, the type of things that were retro or some other things would you be willing to send it in? And it's something that we could repair on the show. And boy, has everybody answered that. I like big time. And when I say big time, I'm not kidding, because I've started receiving full size arcade cabinets. Uh-huh. And I mean, these are the monsters that you went to the mall and, you know, played games on and that type of a thing. They're the size of a refrigerator, some of them. And,
yeah.
And we've got and some really good titles too. Golden Axe.
Operation
Wolf. Yeah, that was Gretchen. I think you said that was the first time you played a game like that.
Yeah. Yeah, it was that fun.
that one was really cool. And Operation Wolf is another one. And this thing is a big guy. I mean, this cabinet is absolutely huge. And
it's not it's working. One where you're, right?
But the whole point of this is to fix it on the show. So no, it's not working. It will be. and in fact, you know, trying to figure out what to do with all of this stuff afterwards. And I'm thinking about coming up with some kind of a scheme where maybe we sell some of these things to support the show and donate something. I've always wanted to see us maybe do grants or scholarships or something for the, you know, entertainment recording industry, whatever it may be. And this might be a good way to fund some of that. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, yes, they do have to be fixed and they have to be kept somewhere, which has ended up being my garage for the moment. And it's just, from one standpoint, it's kind of cool, but it has really been something quite amazing. And learning about how these things actually work and what goes on is also quite interesting. So a lot of these cabinets, or all the ones we've gotten so far, are what I would consider retro, you know, 80s, 90s, early 2000s. And all of them had, you know, one thing or the other going on with them. The one that was the worst off was Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and it was dead, although it was also one of the newer ones made by a company called Arcade 1-Up that makes reproduction cabinets. So in this case, unlike the real antique consoles, it just had a small logic board inside, and it actually ran off of a 12-volt power supply, wall wart type thing like you get with a lot of stuff. And as near as we can figure, somebody plugged in at least a 50-volt AC converter and just burned the thing up. So we've decided from this to create a couple of fun projects. And one of them is on that cabinet, we're going to convert it over to a thing called RetroPie that allows you to play a lot of different games, you know, from different eras and that type of a thing, and set it up for that. And, you know, maybe we can eventually put that somewhere where kids can enjoy it or something like that. We'll have to figure out that standpoint. And then some of the other ones, like the Operation Wolf, I think we're going to go ahead and do a full restore on that one with side art and the electronics and everything. But I don't know. It's just been kind of an interesting thing. Now, I got to tell you one thing. Until we can change the physics, I don't think I can fit any more of these in my garage.
No.
And I'm getting an Asteroids Deluxe, which I'm going to figure out a way to fit in the garage.
No. There's also a lot of...
Gretchen, you've seen all this stuff. And Bill, you've seen pictures. What do you think about this? I mean, it was unexpected.
There's a lot of scary stuff in those cabinets that you do not want to touch. Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, actually, that is very true, because they're designed to be worked on by professionals. So you, when you take the back off, a lot of the voltages are just exposed, including the CRT monitors, which most of these run on the old Picture 2 monitors, that can pull upwards of 40,000 volts to operate. And then, of course, you have line voltage, you know, the power just going into it. And that is just really something that has been quite amazing. And Gretchen, like you say, you want to be very, very careful. So on the topic of arcade games, Bill, Gretchen, what is your favorite? I know, Gretchen, you didn't play a lot of these, but you had a little bit. And Bill, I know you have. So let's start with you. What, if you had to look back, what's your favorite actual arcade game that you played in an arcade?
Oh, Guilty Gear was one of them.
Okay.
There's a sniper game that's kind of like Operation Wolf where it has the gun.
Right.
Yeah, there's a sniper one like that that I really appreciated. And, oh God, was it? I can't remember the name of the game, but it's another pistol one.
Area 51 is another one that I'm probably going to end up with here too, that's like that, that is cool. But yeah, a lot of the, you know, one of the unique things about having these cabinets is a lot of this stuff has been ported to home video game systems. Now, in the 80s and 90s, the ports were usually nowhere near what the arcade was. Today, they're pretty close. But Bill, like you're saying, something with a special controller like that, whether it's the machine gun on the, or, you know, the Operation Wolf, I'm having trouble keeping all my games straight, the Operation Wolf, or something else, it's not easy to replicate the controller, even on a modern home system, you know? So
yeah.
That still makes it pretty unique. All right, Gretchen, I'm going to put you on the spot. I know you didn't play a lot of arcade games, but you have a few. What would you have to say is one of your favorites?
Okay, there was a Star Wars one where you actually like sat inside of the cabinet and you were like flying. That one, there was a really cool one from Tron. And then there was a stand-up game that I always forget what it, Tempest. I liked Tempest.
Yeah, that was cool.
Okay, yeah.
And you said that I have a theme running through all of mine. They're all Vector? Is that what you're calling them?
They're all Vector. Yeah, I don't know about Tron. I'd have to look at that one. And there's a number of different versions of that. But the others are Tempest and Star Wars and like my Asteroids. And yeah, this is another thing, too, that you can't easily replicate on a home system because we generally don't have Vector monitors in our living room, you know? And that's also kind of a cool thing. And certainly in the period that these were made, when 8-bit graphics were kind of the thing and it wasn't as sharp as it is now and all of that, the Vector games really were. I mean, it was a beautiful, bright, in some cases colorful, because there were color Vector monitors. The operators hated them, but the players loved them, you know, and mainly because they only seemed to work for about 6 months and then you have to rebuild them, which is still the case today. But, you know, it just, it's kind of cool. I'll let you take a guess. What do you think my favorite arcade game from the era is?
Wizard of War.
Oh, man, how did you ever guess that?
So,
yeah, another cabinet I'm lucky enough to have. And that one uses voice synthesis, same one as Q-Bert and some other games of the era.
Is it? And that one was, I'm full of spite. You know?
Or actually, I'm out of spite.
Oh,
I'm out of spite.
Spite
means put a quarter in.
Oh.
Out of spite means put a quarter in. That's the attract sounds. Yeah. So,
okay.
but yeah, so it'll be kind of fun to see where this is going. And we'll talk about it here on the show or check out Bill Builds, plug. And I'll give you the information on how to do that as soon as the episodes are live. This is User Friendly 2.0. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back. This is User-Friendly 2.0. Check out our website for everything user-friendly. Userfriendly.show is your one stop to submit questions, playback episodes, and just about everything else we can think of. So check it out. And I don't know about you, but times in my life, I've always wanted to be a Viking. I think that would be a lot of fun, you know, meet interesting people, kill them, that kind of thing, right? So on that venue, Bill, I know that you've been playing a new role-playing game. So why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, it came out on May 21st. It's called Age of Vikings. It's produced by Chaosium, people who bring us RuneQuest and Call of Cthulhu. And it uses their basic role-playing system, which is common to those other games. So it's a percentile game you roll under. And yeah, it's set in Iceland and more of a mythological Iceland than reality.
Okay, so like the old gods, that kind of thing.
Yeah, old gods, giants, elves,
volcanoes.
You know, volcanoes.
Yeah, I believe the gods called those Jotuns, but anyway, yes.
Yeah, Jotuns. So yeah, you get all kinds of different things in it, magic, all kinds of unique things to it. And it's a very detailed system. I was not expecting how much detail it went into just in character creation alone. You know, there's usually a lot of that goes into creating a character for Call of Cthulhu, per se. This goes even steps farther beyond that. And to add in, like, oh, my grandparents fought in the Battle of blah, 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 and my parents were this, and it's a lot of detail.
So I have a question now, because it's in Iceland. So if your party is out doing something and somebody picks up a rock and moves it, is your whole party cursed?
I don't think that's exactly mentioned in this book.
Oh,
I mean, that is good lore, though. I would definitely put it in my game. Because that is a myth.
totally makes sense. So I know you've hit upon the mechanics a little bit, but what would a campaign be like? If you were running I don't know if you're going to, but if you were running one, what kind of a storyline would you put together?
Oh, it comes with a lot of different story hooks. A lot of it's, you know, thinking about the raiding era of Viking lore. So it has extensive rules on seafaring. And different obstacles and things that you can do during that, you know, oceanic battles, pulling up on someone's beach and raiding their village, you know, that kind of thing. It's got storms, monsters, you know, different magics and stuff that can affect it and all that. So it's really got quite a interesting just plain out campaign setting, really.
Cool. So
now, as somebody I know, Bill, that you've in college have studied these different things and stuff, how accurate is it? I know obviously it's a fictional game and I get that, but if you were to look at that and look at actual mythology, does it pretty much track or is it taking some liberties?
If you are hardcore to the Eddas and Sagas, believing that they were written correctly, which many scholars would disagree based on who wrote the Eddas and Sagas down. Mm-hmm. I have a hard time with the Loki and Hel being called despicable gods or some of the other mythological beings placed in, you know, bad roles or good roles or this or that when it was more of a gray area, it appeared. So historically, it's not accurate. And it states that. It early in the book, it states that this is, you know, taking some liberties.
More like Marvel.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, it is.
Okay.
It's got a Marvel problem to it.
Oh, gosh.
Too cool.
Have you had a chance to actually, like, have a group of people play this game?
I have
or
not. I kind of see how it goes. My only thing is that they changed how, like, injury mechanics work.
Mm-hmm.
So you get attacked by, like, per body part now instead of just an overall hit point pool. So you can be maimed or have something severed. Or flat out, you know, killed if you're dismembered or disemboweled.
So if your character gets hit in the arm and it gets chopped off, it you can only use a sword or just a shield and that's it? And you're kicking people?
So how would the mechanics for that work? I mean, is it like real detailed where you have to keep track of all this stuff or do they have a way to do it where it's not so intense?
Your hit points are split out to different body parts. And then you're rolling a dice to determine which body part is getting hit. And then your armor and your shield and all that kind of stuff factors into how much damage you actually take and what's counting as, you know, lethal damage or severed damage or maimed damage.
So this would really appeal to people who are ultra picky about things being realistic in a combat situation, maybe, as opposed to other people who like the role playing, you know, interaction. Is it like that?
I'd say it falls between the two, just because of how Chaosium writes their stuff. As far as the combat and other things are, it's very detailed. This book even covers things like holidays and things like that, that, I mean, you usually don't see covered in books. So it's very mathematic,
okay.
I guess is the way to put it. There's a lot of math.
Probably the best term for it, but yeah, it's the reason I asked the question on the difficulty of it is because, as we all know, we've tested some things, and sometimes for accuracy, we've run into a few things where it gets so in depth that it's 6 hours to build a character, you know, stuff like that. And sometimes I think that takes a little bit too much the other way. But from what you're saying, it sounds like this may fall somewhere in the middle.
Yeah. I'd say it's got, once you understand how combat works and different things like that, I'd say that it is smoother to run once you understand it. It's not as smooth as, say, Call of Cthulhu, in my opinion. But it's not as complicated as, say, probably that Star Trek one we did.
Oh, my goodness, that was terrible.
Okay, so let me give the context on this. Although I did certainly whine about it afterwards, I know, here a few years ago.
That was quite a few years ago.
Yeah, I was going to say, during the COVID era is when this happened, and we, you know, couldn't get together, so we were gaming on Roll20, which is a website that was then and still now is a good place to be able to use as a virtual tabletop. So if you have people who are a distance, or during that time you can't walk out your front door, it was a good way to do it. So in that, we decided to try out some new things, and we all took a turn at running the game and our group. And I was up and I thought, you know, I'm a huge fan of Star Trek, and there's a Star Trek role-playing game, so let's give it a go. Well, I did not realize I was going to have to complete Starfleet Academy to even be able to understand the basics of this thing. It was just... And we got our storyline, and we had some trouble too with the software. I know it just wasn't a good day, but once we got into it, the first part of it, we got the characters, got through all of that. But then when we got into combat, I still haven't completely figured that out. And then the other part of it was there is a system in that for combat in your ship, which is even more complicated. So I don't know. That to me is a little over the top.
It made it so difficult to figure out the different, like what action you were going to take, that it took away from the game. You were no longer having fun. You were feeling frustrated about trying to figure out how to play the game. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's difficult to come up with games that are equitable, you know, between, you know, how things operate. It's a talent.
Yeah, I'd say this Age of Vikings game, it puts a lot of responsibility on the dungeon master or game master to know, okay, well, I want you to roll this and or that. And so it lends more to the role play side than the dice side. Because, like I said, combat is a lot more lethal, parent, you know, in this game than it comes off to be at first.
Huh.
I think I'd have a lot of fun with the role play in that. And, you know, just when you look at these type of things, and I just have to give this as a scholar of certain things, but Viking is actually a verb, and it referred to the people of the North going out and doing raids. So you would go Viking. You weren't a Viking, right? But it is definitely something I know we've studied and that type of a thing. So I think the role play aspect of it, especially if it focuses on that, could be a lot of fun. I mean, I could play a Viking type character, you know?
You have played a Viking type character. I've seen you play D&D.
Yeah,
this is true. This is very true. And World of Warcraft, and I figured out how to do it in Cyberpunk too. So there you are. My goodness, Vikings with implants. Yeah, that would have been very interesting. But yeah, at the end of the day,
they would have called you Odin.
Yeah, there you are. Right? At the end of the day, it would be fun to do some playtesting on these type of things. I don't know, would you like to play test a game with us? Let us know on the website at userfriendly.show. It'd be kind of fun to maybe experiment with something like that, because you can do these things virtually. And I don't know, Bill, how do you do that? Because if you're going to evaluate a game, you seems like you would really need to play test it. You have enough expertise that you would be able to go through the books and understand most of it, I think. But wouldn't it still be important to actually play it through and just see what the real application of it is? Or do you think you were able to just get it from reading the book?
With my experience, I kind of get it from reading the book. Just gauging like what I've played before versus what I've, you know, have played. You know, I've had a wide breadth between, I'd say, Dungeon Slayers, which is this very simple, very straightforward 6-stat game. Roll a d20 and gauge it against that, versus probably my nightmare, which was Triton. No offense to those out there who wrote that game, but like they said themselves, they aren't holding anybody's hands, so that was an experience learning that game. Just to make a character even was just a nightmare for me. And I've played a wide breadth of different things. Dungeons and Dragons is my go-to, but Fabula Ultima, things like that, they're just even in ways different than Dungeons and Dragons I've played. And I have understanding because, like I said, this uses the basic role-playing system that Chaosium made, so I understand the basis from playing Call of Cthulhu of how this is going to play out. But I would love to play it someday.
Maybe we need to make that happen, because that just sounds absolutely interesting. And I know when you dig into these things, it can be a lot of fun. And we've been playing a game up here that's based in 1920s Portland. And it's really been a lot of fun. And this one, I'm actually not playing a character like, some of the ones we've talked about. I'm a engineer, which has really been different to try to pull off, because it's a completely different mindset.
Yeah, you're the engineer who always wants to visit the cat house.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's just normal for... But anyway, I'm not sure that that's limited to engineers now or in the 1920s. So, you know, there you are. But
And there's also like a steampunk twist to this game, too. It's not normal 1920s. There is some variation in there.
Savage Worlds is the system, and we've got some stuff like electric cars. I know was another one that was a little bit interesting, but it's kind of fun the way that all is blended together. And I could see where, you know, something like that is not everybody can like it either, but for those that do, it's a lot of fun. And I think where I'm going with this, with that Age of Vikings, Dungeons and Dragons, it seems like if you have a specific even niche that you like and would like to role play, there's probably something out there that's designed for it. And you don't have to sit with just one system or something like that. You can actually pick and choose. And Bill, I know you're not going to know the exact number off the top of your head, but there are a lot of different role playing games now out there, aren't you? If you were to just do a search, you would get more than 5 or 10, right?
Oh, easily hundreds. The debacle that, Wizards of the Coast went through here the last couple of years. They kind of kicked a lot of people in the butt to make their own systems. So it's even been kind of an explosion that way. Like Daggerheart just came out, which was made by the Crit Roll team, Matthew Mercer and such. And so, I mean, there's a lot of different systems and a lot of different things to play. And all levels of different complexity, different math levels. Some don't even use math.
Yep.
One of my favorite games is called Dread. It uses a Jenga tower.
Dread, I've never heard of that, but that could be very interesting, you know? And
yeah,
you mentioned
it's
Critical. Go ahead.
It's a horror-themed one, so you play it and you have to pull out the Jenga blocks to do a different action. So if it collapses, then that's a critical failure and something horrible is happening.
I think you would not want to play that one after a night at the bar.
So a lot of these books are often really pretty. There's artwork and drawings and topography. Are these books pleasant to look at?
Age of Vikings is definitely pleasant. It definitely puts you in that feeling of the Viking era. The artwork is very clean, very showy to that style. They did very good on designing their characters and such that they used in there. The garb and all that kind of stuff is very historical looking.
Cool. And you know, it's interesting because that all varies too. There's a lot that goes into the artwork, I know, in a lot of these. And like you say, it is very, very beautiful to look at. And it's just as diverse as the stories and the guidelines themselves. And, you know, so it's doing a little research probably makes a lot of sense in trying them out. There's groups all over the internet where you can just jump in and, you know, try these different things. It's, and they'll be okay with the fact that you might be a beginner. Right now, I'm with a group that's playtesting the new Shadowrun 6, World 6. And Shadowrun's a game, the last time I played it would have been about 25 years ago now. And there are some things that are similar and some things that are not. But I am not sure if you were just starting out gaming, that would be the one to pick up. Because it is definitely complicated.
not to be downer, but yeah, that's not a newbie-friendly game. I've been following Shadowrun for many years. I have, I think, 3rd through 5th edition books, and I would say that, you know, it takes a little bit more knowledge and experience to be playing Shadowrun just over the years, even.
Yeah, this is kind of a funny story on that. So we're putting together our characters, as you do, and Shadowrun is one that takes a little longer to develop the character than most. I would say, if you disagree with me on that, say so, but it just seemed like there was a lot more you had to do. So I went on the chat GPT and I typed in, make me a Shadowrun 6e character sheet for a cyborg Viking type character that's a troll. 10 seconds later, bloop, there it is. And it was better than what I would have ever done doing it myself. So, you know, I thought about trying to invite ChatGPT to play the game with us. I still might. So we'll see. But you know.
Jeez.
Hey, you might be a good player. Who knows?
No, I'd be up for it. But, you know, and let me ask you this question, too, because you run a lot of these games. Do you have a problem with people using AI to generate characters and that type of thing? Is that even a controversy? I haven't heard much about it, and it just kind of came to me to try it out, and I was a little surprised because it even got it down to giving me the PDF of the fillable character sheet when it was done. So it was pretty complete.
Wow.
If you had a player, you know, and again, this is just playtesting. I don't know if I'd do that if I was really going to do a campaign. But if you had a player come up and said, oh, yeah, I had AI generate my character sheet, how would you feel about that?
Personally, it depends on the system. AI can probably get the math and stuff correct if it's done trained correctly, you know, in my opinion. But I feel like it takes away a lot of player agency.
Yeah, I mean, I had to look up what some of the skills were because I had no clue, you know, and there definitely was that type of a thing, too. And I think I would say this for the first time putting a character together in that system, it was very helpful because one of the things I did create, whether or not I would use the character, is a completed character sheet that I could reference, which does not appear in the book. It's like, you kind of have to figure it all out. There's instructions on what to do and that type of a thing. But I don't know, for me, and maybe it's because I'm a programmer, but I do good looking at an end product and kind of reverse engineering it a lot of times better than going the other way around. I don't know. How do you feel about that?
Really? It didn't have sample characters in it? Because, I mean, the past editions did.
I don't know if it did. I don't know if it's a dungeon master in that system, but the person running our game did not give us access to that. And we only have one book, so it was somewhat controlled.
Oh, okay. No, I mean, that's a thing that I've always felt is very important in games, is having the sample characters so you can be like, oh, okay, that's why I got it wrong. Or I got it right, you know?
Huh. Yeah, I'm always pretty pathetic on creating the characters. Ever since Pathfinder, I've been completely confused. So I was like, oh, I have this cool sounding character. I can't do anything. Oh, and I got killed by a bunch of little small sprite things. You know? It's like, no, this isn't good.
Those kind of things can be a bummer. And that's one thing, too. Play groups that I work with, if you die, you usually can get yourself back to life somehow. But there are people that get very intense. Oh, you're going to tear up the character sheet. Really? I don't think I'd be that interested in that. But, and Gretchen, you know, I also know you've run games too, like Dungeons and Dragons. And
I remember you talked about this,
you ended up with a war with like 500 different enemies that you were trying to keep track of. I will never forget that.
Well, it's because I wrote it. And what I did was I created the world, I created the situation, and I made variable situations depending on where you guys decided to go. So that war wouldn't have happened, but I had to come up with things that would happen in case you went in wherever these directions pulled you. And we used to not follow the book exactly. It was a lot of up to the dungeon master to, you know, his discretion or her discretion. And so I was trying to run it that way. But I don't have enough of the mechanical skills to really pull off being a really good dungeon master. I can write great stories and little, you know, things going on, but actually running the game is really hard for me. So I kind of figure, maybe I should leave that to you guys.
I don't know, I thought you did just fine with that. It was just amusing because we went through all our figs, all of the candy in my candy jar, and we're using coins to have, you know, placers for all of these different things.
Yes, that's right. I was not expecting you guys to go that direction. And I rolled the dice to figure out how many bad guys were going to be there. And that's what turned up. So it's like,
yeah, but you used 10D100s. I mean, that was a little strange to start. Not really, but you know. No, but at the end of the day, you know, what do they say? What screws up a good campaign is the players or something like that.
We were really good at that.
Yeah, I think we still are in doing some strange things. And with the 1920s game, both Gretchen and I are very much into history. Bill, you are too, I know. And with all that kind of thing, we will, not on purpose, but start drilling down on very specific topics once in a while. Like, we are in this church, right? And I think the storyteller, whatever on that, he knows what a church is, right? But not really the differences between them. So we're asking, well, is this Russian Orthodox or Greek Orthodox or Roman Catholic or Lutheran?
I wanted specifics.
Specifics, because then you figure out, well, what kind of documentation and where do you look and how is it stored? And we finally, it was just said to us that if we did that again, we probably wouldn't survive much longer. So
I did that with a game. A friend of mine was running a werewolf game that was set in the Wild West, and we ended up in a mine, and I'm like, well, where's a stope and all this? And he's like, what the heck is a stope?
Oh, geez.
The details, you know, but no, he's actually doing an amazing job running the game. It has really been just a lot of fun. And my go-to, like you say, was always Dungeons and Dragons. It still is, but this has been a different one that's just been fun. So sometimes it is fun to, you know, look at different things, and you may never do it again, or you may like it. You know, who knows where you're going to go from there. So we'll have to see where this ends up. Well, anyway, until next week, this is User-Friendly 2.0, keeping you safe on the cutting edge.
User-Friendly 2.0, copyright 2013 to 2025 by User-Friendly Media Group Incorporated. All rights reserved. Content is the opinion of the show's participants and not necessarily this station or platform. Requests for material use, interviews, CCPA, privacy notice for California residents, GDPR information for UK and EU residents, and any other feedback may be submitted at userfriendly.show. We welcome your input. Thank you for listening.